Quick announcement before we start the podcast. I'm coming up on my 100th episode, and I thought it would be fun to have you guys ask me some questions. So for the 100th episode, I would love for you to reach out, send me an email. You can find the link at lynchen.com/connect. Fill out the form, ask me anything, and I will answer your question. And then while you're there on your laptop, why not write a review? Would love that. Okay, stay tuned for my interview with Win Tran from Starry Kitchen. I have to apologize. We tried doing this via Skype as normal, but there were some sound issues, so eventually we just hopped on the phone. There are some little bits of noise, and you might not be able to hear him as well as you would had we done it via Skype, but I still think it's a really great interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Win, you and I have known each other since, what, 2009?
It's even 2008, 2009, so somewhere around there, yeah, that's about right, yeah.
We met when we were both working on the indie film White on Rice, and...
Yeah, that's where I got my banana suit from, where I stole it from.
Yeah, we'll go into that a little bit, and I just remember, I remember you being, like, this effervescent... buoyant personality that you still are, and you bringing food to one of the screenings, and it was your wife T's. It was a burrito, and
yeah, it was on Sunset, right? That when that the Sunset Five or something like that, whatever that movie theater was.
Yeah. You brought these burritos, and you were like, "If anyone's hungry," and I was like, "Me," and I grabbed it, and I remember when I ate it, I thought to myself, this is one of the best burritos I've ever had, and it's not even fresh. Like, you've had it in your bag for, like, at least 3 or 4 hours. And I was like, if this is this good sitting in his bag, just imagine what it would be like fresh. And that's when you told me about your, quote-unquote, illegal kitchen. And that's how the whole thing started. And here we are all these years later, many restaurants... and a cookbook.
Yeah, who would have thunk it? I mean, that's crazy, right? To think like that.
So let's go back to that time. Tell us about the banana suit, the history of the banana suit, which I know, but let's tell everyone else. It's in the book, too, which I love.
But yeah, it is the book. Well, so on White and Rice, you know, Dave Boyle, and I, you know, so I represented the film to get it distribution, which means sometimes films are made independently, and this was. And, you know, with independent money and people that were friends of David that put money into the movie, but then it didn't have a way to get into theaters and on DVD, which is very popular at the time. And, you know, at one point in time, we were like, you know what, we can't give it to, like, a Warner Brothers or a Miramax or, a Weinstein Brothers. No one's going to take it. We're just going to take it on the road ourselves. And in doing that, it was a very grassroots thing. And, you know, in the movie, there's a character... that Joy plays, like Joy Osmeski plays, right?
Mary, I believe her name was.
Yeah, and her official name in the movie is Banana Girl, right?
I believe so. Yes, he called her Banana Girl because she was dressed up as a banana for Halloween, and he was dressed up as a gorilla, and we were joking that they made a cute couple.
Yeah, exactly. But I remember one time when we were starting to plan to promote the film, I just told Dave one time, I was like, look. I know this is not going to make any sense, but just give me the banana suit. He's like, what are you going to do? And I was like, I can't explain it, but I'm going to do some crazy stuff with it. And, you know, when we started going on the road to promote the film, I would, like, you know, ride in cities. Like, I'd ride a bike in cities. I would crash parades in it. I'd try to get on TV on it. I'd wear a sign. I'd, you know, go to college campuses and take pictures and go to screenings and... it was amazing just the magic that happens from a simple yellow piece of cloth that you slip on. And, you know, I always say it's the least creepy outfit you can wear, but it's also the one kind of outfit that people just get and no one questions, and it always gives them a really big smile. And I've never been groped so much in my life wearing a banana suit by men and women alike and sometimes together. So, yeah, and that is the inception of the magic of a banana suit.
Yeah, it was funny to see... one day you in a banana suit and me being like, wait a second, wow, that really worked.
Yeah, it's, and you know, I didn't actually, it's not like I knew, but I just had a feeling it'd be really fun. And that's, you know, that's all it was. And yeah, and it did. And, you know, it's funny because Dave, I don't know if you ever saw this, but Dave wrote an article for, I think, Filmmaker Magazine about whether or not the banana suit actually helped the film or hurt the film. And by the way, I still haven't read the article to this day, even though Dave is the nicest guy. I'm just so scared that he's going to say it hurt the film, even though we're still friends. So I'm assuming it didn't hurt the film so bad.
I don't think it hurt the film. So, flash forward, banana suit. So, let's talk about that burrito that you brought. So, back then, how was the burrito made? Where was it made?
So in the middle of us working on the film, you know, we are in the middle of the fall of the economy, which is important. And, you know, it's the parallel of why we weren't able to find our own distribution to get in the theaters and why we pursued to get in the theaters. So, my wife and I, you know, at one point in time, started an illegal underground restaurant out of our apartment, and not out of just being cool, but because my wife lost her job in advertising in April 2009, and we had nothing better to do, and I was like, honey, let's just start an illegal restaurant out of our apartment because we ain't got shit to do. And then we started, and the idea was really simple. We'd make pancakes and comfort food, being dishes that, like, peasant food that every Asian had in their home, but doesn't necessarily get found in most restaurants. And but we wanted to make it, like, you know, Chipotle style. So, you know, you go into Chipotle, you can get, like, a, you know, pork, chicken, you know, carnitas or something like that, and you can have it as a taco, a burrito, or a salad bowl. So our version of that is you can get, like, a rice plate, a taco, or a burrito. And I think, I'm pretty sure the dish that we made for you was a lemongrass chicken.
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, and what we do is every time we made food, we'd rotate it. We'd only make one dish at a time, and that was the menu. There wasn't really a menu. It was more like, this week we're making lemongrass chicken, this week we're making braised coconut, caramelized pork belly. And I seem to remember, because we would have made it for you because we were probably coming off of, you know, serving that night and probably had leftovers, but good leftovers. I mean, they weren't
the best leftovers.
If they were leftovers and they sat for a couple hours and they got to you and they were not so bad.
They were excellent, not only not so bad.
and that, you know, that was happening in parallel for when it was working the film, but we didn't think it would be something real. It was more like, this is something fun to do, make a little extra cash. And it ended up being very bohemian and romantic, and not in the sense of, like, love, but romantic in the sense of just how, like, a lot of filmmakers, a lot of our friends would come together and basically hang out on our patio and just be part of the Star Kitchen story, and it brought people together, and that's all we thought it was going to be. It's like, oh, this is kind of fun. It's summer of 2009. Everyone is broke. You know, there's no money. We're all in this together, and somehow we're going to figure this out. And that was, you know, that was that year of Starry Kitchen.
How did you come up with the name Starry Kitchen?
So, it took me actually 3 weeks to convince my wife to start doing this. She thought I was crazy, which rightfully so, like, confirm. But then when I finally coerced her on a Thursday night before we started on that Sunday, I was like, honey, so whatever this is, if this works, whatever it is, we have to give it a name. Because once we give it a name, we're going to be stuck with it the entire way through. And 10 seconds later, my wife's like, Starry Kitchen. And that is basically, at the time, the name of her favorite cooking show from Hong Kong. And if anyone's Cantonese speaking, the most popular, if you're not Cantonese speaking, the most popular channel out of Hong Kong is TVB, and it was on TVB, and that's all it was. It was her favorite cooking show from Hong Kong.
Wow. Huh. Who knew? I don't know. So it was called Starry Kitchen, or it was called Starry Kitchen in Cantonese?
It's called Starry Kitchen in the English translation. Oh, my God. I used to know the Cantonese. Like that. I'm Vietnamese, guys, and I can barely speak Vietnamese too. But I'm not even gonna try it. Someone's gonna be like, your Cantonese is horrible. I know it's horrible. I don't speak Cantonese.
That's pretty impressive.
That's the only thing I know is in Cantonese.
Well, so how did you know that a restaurant would be a good idea? Was T like this incredible cook already, and you were like, every time you ate a meal of hers, you were like, you should open a restaurant that's that good? Or how did this come about?
Well, to understand all of history of Starry Kitchen is to really understand that we don't know. I didn't know that. I knew that my wife was talented. And you know what it really stems from? So in film, I used to work at a place called William Morris, the talent agency. And, you know, talent agents have a pretty bad rap, you know, entourage, all that stuff. But they're intense, and that is true. But there's something about talent agents, and you learn that in talent agency, that no one really articulates is, you know, part of your job is to be able to identify talent and pull it out of them and see what you can do to kind of foster that. So I had no idea that running a restaurant would have been the thing. But I could see my wife's talent flourish through her creation of food. And this is the first time at this point in time, it's 2009. We've been together for 8 years. This is the first time I've seen her be really passionate about any one thing. So I was like, this is the thing we're going to try to foster to see if this is something real. And that's all it was. Like, everything we've done is out of necessity or just based on an impulse. It's not like we're going to run a restaurant empire. I'm going to get a cookbook. I'm going to get on TV. Like, we don't know. Like, I still say we're failing upwards, to be honest with you. Like, I think we're really fortunate and very lucky, and we're not unappreciative of the success that we've had. But we had no idea.
Can you remember one of the first things she cooked for you that really wowed you?
Like, kitchen-wise or just...
Just in life.
Dating.
Yeah.
In life? God, because, well, first of all, she was the first woman I've ever dated that could cook. I think, you know what it is? She makes a Vietnamese dish called bún riêu, which is a Vietnamese soup made of, like, pork broth and minced crab and minced lobster, and has, like, tomato base mixed in with the pork broth and noodles, and has mint and shredded cabbage. And I was like, holy crap. And it's funny because even though I grew up Vietnamese, I had a lot of identity issues being Vietnamese, so I rejected most Vietnamese culture growing up. I mean, I know pho, and I know a couple of, like, really, you know, signature things, but when she made that for me, and she's like, oh, yeah, I used to make this when I was a freshman in college. It's like, holy crap, who are you?
Jeez.
It's so complex.
Freshman in college, where was she making this? In her, like, hot pot?
Yeah, she'd make hot pot all the time.
Wow.
I mean, you hit it on the head, like, and you know, and I don't, have I ever told you, Flynn, like, you know, she was forbade from cooking all throughout her, you know, like, you know, her childhood. She was never allowed in the kitchen.
Wow, really?
She was forbade because, you know, and, you know, it's kind of, from an anthropological sense, you know, we're all diaspora, right? And her mom and dad escaped Vietnam. They're Chinese Vietnamese. They escaped Vietnam at the end of the Vietnam War, came to America. And this is very common if you're Jewish or Korean or Vietnamese or any culture that's left a war-stricken country, is that you're leaving to also afford your family a better life. And her mom and dad are very, very rigid about it. Her mom was a seamstress. Her dad is a carpenter. And they're like, you're not getting in the kitchen. We do not want you to have a blue-collar life. You were going to go become an accountant, a lawyer, a pharmacist, a doctor, anything but. But when she went to college, she missed her mom and dad's cooking. And just from sheer observation, and then also sharing notes with her mom over the phone, she was able to recreate those dishes and then evolve it.
That's incredible. I want to hear more about your childhood when you were saying you were sort of shunning the Vietnamese food. What did you grow up eating?
If you look at any cooks from my mom, it's mainly hot dogs and hamburgers. That was a big one. I would eat fried chicken, but not... I'm glad I understand this now. I would eat fried chicken, but I would only eat the skin. Because most times it would be white meat, and I really didn't like it because it was so dry. I ate spaghetti. My mom would make me spaghetti at home a lot. I would eat, like, rice and soy sauce or rice and Maggi, right? It was just really good to me, and, like chili flakes on it, and that was it. Bread, butter, and sugar spread on top of that. Sometimes my mom would make a Vietnamese dish called baluk lak, which is basically the English translation is shaken beef. But the funny thing is, luk lak is actually the sound of, like, stir frying. It's like, luk lak, luk lak, luk lak, which it sounds like I'm making a very condescending sound, but that is actually the sound. It's supposed to be the sound of, like, sautéing, right? So it's actually sautéed beef. But, you know, I didn't eat pho really that much. Not because I didn't like it. I think it represented Vietnamese culture too much for me. And I was just trying to be American and not be different and not called Chinese all the time in school, and not, you know, at the time, and it's funny, at the time, we're doing this interview, like, Wonder Woman just came out, but at the time, Wonder Woman, Linda Carter's Wonder Woman was really popular on TV, and when the kids used to beat me up and pick on me and call me Chinese, sometimes I would spin like Linda Carter's Wonder Woman, because that's how she changed into Wonder Woman,
mm-hmm.
and the kids would be like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm trying to change into Wonder Woman, which is funny now. It's very embarrassing to think about that, but I really did that. I remember spinning to keep the kids away from me, and they were so perplexed, and to hear the words coming out of my mouth was so embarrassing, honestly, because as a boy also, right, you know, you also have, like, gender identity issues as well, I think, because I'm not saying I'm effeminate, and I might be, but I always, you know, align with my female family more than my males, which is something really strange in Asian culture, too. Like, that's not normal. They all thought I was going to be gay growing up, so.
Well, when you were growing up playing Wonder Woman and eating bread with sugar and whatnot, did you ever... Like, were you ever not angry at the Vietnamese culture, but you were just sort of were like ashamed by it? Was that what it was? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
It's hard to articulate in few words, right? It's not that I'm ashamed from it, but I couldn't delineate that I was both, right? That I was both, you know, I was living in America, but I am from Vietnamese. I'm Vietnamese in origin and culture, and that's why I live with at home. And, you know, as a kid, even though I, as an adult, love sticking out now, and I'm unapologetic, and I'm very confident in who I am, and I'm happy to share that, as a kid, I didn't want to be different. And it's really tough when the majority of your day you're spending with other kids your age, and you are not part of the group, and they let it be known that you're not part of the group. And it's hard to convey that to your parents that may not understand that, you know, upbringing, because, you know, my parents are Vietnamese and they can't grew up in Vietnam. So, I mean, every kid has it hard, so don't get me wrong. But, you know, when you have cultural identity issues, it did make me hate being Vietnamese for a while. You know, I remember, like, I learned English by watching television and watching Dan Rather on TV, and I did that so I could expedite my assimilation into the American culture and being white. And being not Chinese, even though I'm not even Chinese, I'm Vietnamese, right? So I don't know. It's even thinking about it today, it stirs up a whole ball of emotions that it's not that I'm comfortable with anymore, but it's pretty complicated. And also, I was really shy. So on top of all that, I as a person, as an adult, am the antithesis of what I was as a child. And I overcame all that, but I was super shy. I couldn't express my emotions or my thoughts. I'd run away from everything. I wouldn't speak up. And I was a Chinese, Vietnamese, American kid who didn't know who he was.
When did things start to shift for you?
One of the pivotal moments was sixth grade, when one of the bullies that I was still growing up with finally apologized to me. And that was really... It was really cathartic, and I'm not even sure that's even the right word, because it was so eye-opening. And it's funny, because he just messaged me this morning, right about that, and we're friends. His name is Jeff Smith, and he just came up to me and said, look, man, before, you know, school and during in daycare, I was really mean to you because I just didn't understand, and I'm so sorry about that.
Sixth grade?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Sixth grade he did this?
Sixth grade, yes.
Wow, that's so enlightened for a 12-year-old.
Yeah, but you have to understand, he's been making fun of me since I was four.
Right.
So this is 8 years later. So and he's also been growing up with me. And it was really interesting when he did that. And I never asked him where that stemmed from, nor do I necessarily care. But I think just the fact that he did that, it really made an impact on me. It made me feel, and that's also, at that point in time, I'm also hitting puberty, so now I'm hitting another uneasy time in my life. But that changed a lot and gave me a little bit more self-confidence. And I say, I emphasize little, because that's not easy to unwind that many years of cultural anguish. But that was a big deal for me. And, you know, we're friends still to this day. And I blew it off like it was nothing at the time. But it meant so much to me. It meant the world to me that this guy who was my bully, you know, since before kindergarten, is now my friend and now actually understands and appreciates my culture. That meant a whole lot.
Wow. How did you go from someone who was only eating soy sauce and rice to somebody who knows what pandan and fish sauce can do to a dish?
You know, it's funny. I was talking to someone that was also from Dallas. And, you know, when you're from a place that isn't the place that you reside anymore, it's easy for you and that other person technically to shit on that place. Like, well, aren't you glad you're out? And I say no, because, you know, it's who I am. And the thing about Dallas was, it's Dallas and my upbringing and, you know, being shy and being kind of reclusive. I always wanted to change. So in Dallas is a city for me. I yearn for more. Like, I wanted to see more of the world. I wanted to see these places, these countries, these cultures. And so that made me really curious about the world. Being shy and not being able to express myself, eventually I would build up a kind of anger that would be fostered into some kind of, I don't know, just like passion of like, you know what, I need to become a different person. So I'm so unhappy as I am now. Like, I need to be try to become more talkative. And I don't even know what happened. Like, I smile a lot today, but when I was a kid, I didn't. And I don't remember exactly the time in my life. I think it was like when I was in eighth grade transitioning into high school. I was like, you know what, I am just going to start smiling all the time now. And I'm going to say the kids, I'm 39, the term the kids use today, I've heard is fake it, you know, fake it till you make it. That's kind of what I did. I was like, you know, I'm just going to exude happiness. I think something is going to change my life. And that created like an avalanche of change in my life. Like, I would become more happy. I started becoming more interested in other people's cultures. I started meeting people from other cultures and going to their houses and eating all these different kinds of foods. And that, you know, our experiences make us who we are. And that's what it is, like the building blocks. And you can't predict what it is, but every time you get exposed to something new, at least for me, I become more curious. And not necessarily about that culture, but about the world. And then it really changed when my parents finally took me to Vietnam. It was my first international trip I've ever taken when I was 18 years old. And number one, because of me, number two, is to see the culture outside of America, the bubble of where we live, changed everything. Just to see people that were impoverished but happier than I've ever seen people in America, to be experienced to the food that I grew up with, but in the actual country of origin, and how much better it tasted when you understood finally where it came from, what it meant, and, you know, the socioeconomics of it, which is kind of crazy to bring in as an 18-year-old, but it does, you know, it does mean something. When you eat something where it's from, and then you see the people that are eating it and creating it. And then I just kind of really wanted to travel more, and that just snowballed into me just becoming more curious about the world.
How'd you learn to cook?
I've always had a curiosity for cooking, but, you know, as up until even through adulthood, I've always been a big talker and never completing things. So I attribute all of it to my wife. She is such an amazing cook. She has such a natural born talent that by osmosis, I learned how to cook from her. Like, even recently, the last 2 or 3 years, I've never been, I mean, ultimately behind the scenes, I am one of the chefs because we create all the food together, but I've actually run the kitchen for the last 2 or 3 years since my wife has gotten pregnant and I wanted to take a back seat. I learned how to cook for my wife. I learned how to cook because when you run a restaurant, you realize that you want to be beholden to any one employee and you need to understand all the roles. So also when you know the roles, you can actually, you know, in order to demand respect, you have to give respect as well. And if you know what they're going through, you can actually direct people better. So it's a combination of being around my wife and then running a restaurant and trying to become a better leader. And that's taken a long time to become a better leader. Like, it's not just to become more confident, but become more empathetic towards what your employees are going through and figure out how to grow them in the best way possible. That has forced me to learn how to cook. And it may sound cliche, but it's made me become a better person, I think, as well.
I noticed that your name is on the book, Is there a reason that T's not on?
There is a reason, because T didn't write any of it.
Even the recipes?
Well, she has the basic recipes, and we've worked on that, but I had to translate them into full-blown recipes, which averaged about 4 to 8 hours a recipe, to make it where, and I don't want to, I think the term layman is kind of condescending, as much as I wanted to make it as translatable and understandable for as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But T did write the original recipes. She came up with them, and we worked on them together. But I had to translate every single one of them, which took a very long time. Because, you know, when you have cooks, even as detailed as the recipes are, there's a lot more shorthand in the expectation of their occupation. When translating them into a recipe that hopefully the masses can hopefully understand and digest and create, it is a very different game, and I would sit in a room for hours just trying to, you know, choose the word correctly that would make sure that people would understand it, and then I also had to recalculate all the recipes and double-check them, and then I also, and I'm sure you noticed, but there's also what I call ball-out recipe portions, which is, you know, what is the original recipes, which are for 2 to 4 servings, but then there's the balls out if you want to start to own a legal underground restaurant, 40 to 80 people. And I just recalculate all of that because that was something I wanted to make sure people had. And that was a serious commitment. It's a personal problem. But it was a pretty big headache, but I hope and think it's worth it.
You've sort of been the face of Starry Kitchen all these years. And T is known as Starry Kitchen Ninja, right?
Starry Kitchen Ninja, yeah.
SK Ninja. And so I want to move a little backwards now into, well, not backwards, but we're going to ping pong around. I want to go into the book, but first I want to talk about the original restaurant that was in downtown LA that we always went to for jury duty. That was used in Dave Boyle's other movie that I was in, Surrogate Valentine.
That's right.
And let's talk a little bit about that, because that's when things started to really explode, right?
It is exactly where things started to explode. Our lunch restaurant in Cal Plaza, at the top of Bunker Hill, across the street from what is now known as the Broad Museum. It's funny. So the story that you may not know, Lynn, is that these guys had friends of mine that started a sushi restaurant in that spot the same exact time we started out of our apartment. And I remember us talking, and my friend was like, oh, man, that's cute. You're starting a restaurant out of your apartment. And it was a little condescending about that, but he's also a friend, so I didn't take that so personally. And then 5 to 6 months later, he's like, look, Wynn, this economic crash is hurting us so bad. We made the wrong move. We can't find a buyer to take our space, and we have an idea. What if you can take Starry Kitchen to the next level, and we can make this work? And I was like, I have no idea what that means. He's like, the lunch place, like, I have no idea about lunch. I eat lunch, but I don't know anything about the business of lunch. In fact, I don't know anything about the business of real restaurants. And eventually, we figured it out. We did some test runs there, and it just made sense, partially from a personal development perspective, that, you know, out of the apartment, we were getting really good at that, and there's only so much we could, so far we could take it, that it was time to take the next step. And then we took this lunch restaurant open, or took this lunch restaurant in downtown that we opened in February of 2010. And it was funny because we knew nothing about it. And I always tell people, and I really meant it, I still really mean it, that we were willing to work a lot harder for a lot less business. But, you know, at that time, the food truck revolution was in full gear, right? You know, Kogi, Roy Choi, and all the different food trucks have taken over Los Angeles. And Twitter is the way you find all of them. We were the weirdos, and we went and got a brick and mortar. And we had a similar story, but we went the entirely opposite direction. And what happened was, within the first month of opening that restaurant, we went essentially viral, right? Like, our line went from, like, 5 to 10 people to, like, 50 to 60 people deep. And we would do the 200 to 300 people in about an hour and a half to 2 hours. And it was just get nuts. And it was crazy. And We got it in New Yorker, LA Times, LA Weekly, LA Magazine, NPR, Bravo, AMC, Travel Channel, and we don't have a publicist either. Like, it's just our story and our crazy antics got us in all these publications, and we had no idea where it all came from, so we are very thankful for it all.
And then from there, how did that end and the one in the restaurant in Chinatown begin?
Well, so 2.5 years later, after we started it, our partners had sold the space. And I say right from under us, it was kind of close to that. We were educated that they were going to do that, and it was part of our partnership that they owned the lease and we owned the concept. But it happened much quicker than we thought, and we had to shut down pretty much 2 weeks after that deal closed, which is really fast. And this is something that I don't know if people can relate to, but when you run a business, you know, there's two ways to think about it. One is it's your money, right? It's your business. Two, I think, is a way that we think of it is that we employ people that make a living off of us. And it is irresponsible for us to just put them on the street. And I scrambled to find the next option immediately to make sure we keep these people that we really grew to love and, you know, became part of our dysfunctional family. That's also, you know, not lose that talent, because it took us that long to finally figure out and who we wanted to work with and how, you know, what kind of people we wanted to work with. So we then became a pop-up in the fashion district first. And I took a really bad deal in haste because I felt the pressure, but I wanted to keep my staff employed. And that got us on the first LA Times 101 best restaurant list by Jonathan Gold, which is really crazy. And I even told Jonathan at that time, I was pulling him aside. I remember we were talking. I was like, hey, man, it's cool, man. I know you missed the deadline. You hit save on the wrong file. I'm not going to tell anyone else your secret, but it's cool with me. We experienced the hardest service we ever had because of that. Even though it's a dream to be on a great list like that from the likes of Jonathan Gold, he also gave me the worst experience I've ever had running a restaurant, because the Jonathan Gold effect can send too many people and piss everyone off. But, you know, and that was a great life lesson. I'm really surprised we survived after this point, too, that the fashion district pop-up was very hard. We lost a lot of friends, we lost more money than we can count, we lost confidence. For the next year and a half, we were double negative in our accounts very often. We were destitute, we were desperate, and then eventually what happened was Roy Choi, we were at an event, and Roy from Kogi and Chago was like, hey, Wynn, like, we just moved Chago to Chinatown, it's amazing. Like, I think you should come, you know, join us. And I was like, Roy, I'm not the king of Los Angeles. I can't just move. We have fans, but we're not you. We can't just move and people follow us. But then he introduced me to this guy, George Yu, who I call the king of Chinatown. And he's the guy that's fostered everyone that's in Chinatown. Howling Rays, Bauhaus, Chago, Scoops, anyone you can think of in Chinatown, he's been privy to and has fostered them. And he did the same for us. And we were so impressed with him and the opportunity in Chinatown that we just moved there on a whim, and we took over the Grand Star Jazz Club, which is this classic dive bar. And I say that, you know, cautiously. Like, some people think dive bar means it's a crappy place, but no, it's like it has a lot of heart, has a lot of history. We've been there for like 7 years. And I just thought it'd be awesome for us to serve our food in a place that's unlikely to find our kind of food. And that time, we were serving steamed corn chili crab, roast pork belly, actual fried rice, and all these great dishes that no one would find in most of the city, but could be found in the dive bar in Chinatown.
Yeah, it felt like whenever we went there, like, we were in like a modern film noir.
And the funny thing is, that's not something I could have created, right? That would have been really funny. I was like, this is the idea. That's just what it was already.
Yeah.
That was the beauty of it. And maybe that comes from my film background too. Like, I took appreciation in the heart of natural surroundings. That's something that you can't force. And that was the evolution of a space that's been owned by the same family for 70 years, and I loved it. It was probably, honestly, we still talk about it, me and my wife. It might have been one of the best culinary times we had in the history of Starry Kitchen, because it was a tiny kitchen. We had 9 walks. It was super hot, but we were always there, and we could see our business build, and then we could also see our food just get better, too. It was amazing.
And then what happened after that? Was that the Kickstarter happened after that?
Kickstarter did happen after that. So at a certain point in time, you know, I have a bad history of taking bad deals in haste. And when we went to Chinatown, it was actually a bad deal, but it changed on us and not in our favor anymore. So I bit the bullet for about a year, but eventually we hit a breaking point. And I finally figured out how to articulate it. Like, at the end of the Chinatown days, now, we were on a, like, professional high. Like, we were hotter and bigger than we've ever been in the, at that point in time, the 6 years we've been around. But we were also at a far more emotional low, because it was eating up at our soul, but at the end of it. And my wife pretty much said, look, if we don't get our own place, we can't do this anymore. You got to shut it down. And she was very serious. And there was all, you know, and part of this, too, is that my wife and I have had lots of hardships and hard times in our relationship. Like, I think this restaurant has almost broken us so many times. I can actually point my finger at 3 different time periods where we were possibly about to break up entirely. And I could see that she was really serious, that she would probably have left me if I kept this going. And I needed to not be the overly ambitious, overzealous face of Starry Kitchen anymore. And I needed to figure out how to keep us stable and make us happy. And, you know, it was funny because when we announced the Kickstarter, which I figured out, I was like, look, if we're going to do this, we're going to go big or go home, we got chastised by a lot of people. And in the community, they were like, you know, L.A. is about to become hot shit, and you're part of that story. It is a disservice to you and the community if you leave now. Why are you doing this? And I was like, look, happy people make happy food, and we're not happy anymore. It's as simple as that. And we went into this Kickstarter to raise $500,000, which everyone thinks is a lot of money. And part of the reason I did a Kickstarter, too, is to educate people what the real cost of running a restaurant is, an opening restaurant, and not necessarily to raise all that money. It was to try to raise that money, but it was to educate people, to show them the hardship of what it is. Because everyone knows running a restaurant is really difficult, but no one ever shares those real, tangible stories of why it's so difficult. And it became an incredibly emotional time for us, because the thing that happened through that Kickstarter was all the fans came out of the woodwork and really sent so many messages of love and support and how we touched them and how we affected their lives, and then also donated money towards the Kickstarter campaign. We raised $115,000, which I still think is a lot of money. 4 different individuals put in $10,000, which is, I think, is huge. That was the beginning of my possible empathetic awakening, because I remember crying quite often that night about how this wasn't going to work, but how I was going to let all these people down and put money into us. But then thinking about how many people we touched, and I was really screwed up, and not screwed up in the kind of like insanity, from the point of insanity, but it screwed up in the sense of, you know, I was happy that people were going to put money into us, and I was sad that I might be letting them down because they didn't want us to go away. And it wasn't a very emotional period for us, but I learned a lot. And, you know, the last piece of the Kickstarter is something that I have been able to articulate to people very well, is that the main goal was just to push as hard as possible for another door to open. And I only told 2 or 3 people that because I knew no one else would understand it, and they would also chastise me. Like, what do you mean? Are you lying to people? Like, no, raising the money is important. But showing people that sometimes not knowing what the end goal is more important. Because you can't lay out all your entire path in life. Like, I always think that when you go into job interviews, and I do this through all my interviews whenever I interview employees, but I think the 5-year plan, the 10-year plan is one of the most condescending fucking questions to ask someone. And at least from the perspective of when someone's asking it, I don't think people are asking for genuine interest in personal development of a person. They want that, use that as a metric to see if that person is an ambitious person and that they are
And then did you go, you guys started traveling after that, correct?
We started traveling up north, and we didn't travel much because, you know, it's funny because, you know, the next 7 months of unemployment, which I call fun employment, I tell people was the brokest and the happiest I've ever been. And people are like, well, why don't you travel internationally? And like, I was like, look, let me reiterate, I have no money. I literally have no money. Like, what about credit cards? Like, I don't think you understand. I ran a business. I have no more credit cards. I have no more credit. I have no more credibility. Like, I don't have any of that. But there was a little bit of an infusion of cash because when we were leaving, you know, we got flooded with people. You know, normally in the restaurant, you know, when you we have something we call turns. If a restaurant serves like 40 people in a dining room and you do 80 people a night, that's two turns. The last night we served, we did more than we've ever done. We did like 7.5 turns, which is unbelievable. And they gave us some extra cash, so we went up north to kind of escape from it all and just to eat some food and visit friends that we've been telling them we would visit them for like the last decade, and we finally did. And we cleared our heads. We came back, and we didn't talk about the restaurant business for like 3 months. I was anxious for the next month. I had to not be nervous and anxious to get unwound. We got a book deal in the middle of all of this. I told them to fuck off because I was very sure that we weren't coming back. And next, I figured out why I said that too. And I obviously have a book deal now, so, you know, obviously turn around. I am a bad ex-boyfriend, which sounds like a really bad joke. And I finally figured out why, because it's funny. And you know what's funny, Lynn? Because, you know, I always say to you that you're my favorite episode of Silicon Valley. And I'm now figuring out the epiphany of that. So, Lynn, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, she was in the first season of Silicon Valley where, God, what's his name?
Ehrlich.
I believe the show, too.
Ehrlich?
Yeah, Ehrlich. And he meets you, and you're the wife of a writer that he's already, like, stolen his girlfriend before. And he starts with this line, he's like, have you ever loved someone too much? Right? And,
which was improv, by the way.
You know, yeah, and the yada, yada, yada. He takes you, he gets jumped on the stage, and it's clarity. But here's the epiphany. I do love too much. I love too hard. I am a kind of person that I'm all in or not in. In between doesn't work for me. When I break up with someone, I can't bear to see you, not because I don't like you or I hate you, I have to sever. In order to actually step away, I can't hover around. Otherwise, it pulls me back in. And when we left the restaurant business, I had to sever any association and thought of being back in the restaurant business. So when I got offered a book deal 3 days after we quit, is actually what happened, from HarperCollins, who's one of the big three publishers in the world, I immediately refused them, which was not hard for me at that time because I was like, I was already in a dark place. I'm like, there's no way. I don't care. I don't care what you say. I don't care what you think. But of course, a month later, I cleared my head and I finally wasn't interested anymore. I was like, hey, man, so I'm in a dark place. Can I have that book deal now? Is that cool? It's been a real rollercoaster ride of emotions and self-reflection, and the book is been a big part of that because it's allowed me to articulate those thoughts and words and dig deeper than I've allowed myself to. And if people hate my stories or think they're disingenuous, I can only do so much, but I'm happy that I had the opportunity to kind of at least find myself at the very least. So
the current chapter of your restaurant life is Button Mash. How did that come about?
So Button Mash, the story is pretty simple. In 2012, when we're still at the lunch spot, on Saturday night, I get like it's exaggerated, but it's like a 3 to 4 page email from a fan whose wife eats at our restaurant every day and how much he loves our food and how he has this idea, the crazy idea of a craft beer bar, arcade, Asian restaurant, and why we would be the perfect partners to work with him, and all this stuff trying to convince me why we should do this, and why this is amazing, and why this doesn't exist in America, and actually how I react is I'm of the opinion that you can find 1,000 reasons not to do something, but sometimes there's only one reason to do something because you want to, and I wanted to do that. And 3 years later, top secretly, partially because the restaurant business, like any kind of business, you can, I now have enough experience where I don't want to put too much out there to falsely, you know, I don't want people to have false expectations of us. Like, it's easier to just tell people what we have, not what we're about to have. But if you tell people, you keep on telling people that, like, you're the boy who cried wolf, like, well, I'm about to open this restaurant, I'm about to open that restaurant, and they get excited, and you don't do it, they get really let down, you lose them. And, you know, but my partners, Jordan and Dave, they knew about the Kickstarter, they knew all about that stuff. We didn't mention in those campaigns, not because we were lying, it's because, you know, that also, it's not a Starry Kitchen, so everyone knows that, right? Like, we're part of it. We're partners of it. It's not a fully fledged Starry Kitchen. It's a partnership, collaboration, creatively, and in every other respect. That, and also, we didn't know if it was going to come to fruition either. That was the other thing, too. So, and then all of a sudden, later that year, 7 months after we quit, you know, it starts becoming real. But before that, we also decided that we're going to come back via Uber, which was kind of a crazy idea, just for a fun social experiment to see if anyone cared if we were coming back. And we broke Uber, which is something neither Uber or us expected. And we came back with a vengeance, but not in a mean way as much as, like, in terms of the impact, the impactful vengeance. And then 2 months later, we opened Button Mash. This bar arcade restaurant next to Dodger Stadium in Echo Park. And it was funny because this is the first time we did something where we didn't tell any of the press. You know, we have created really great relationships. And we had, also, you and I had a relationship even before we became a food blogger. But, you know, we know a lot of the food bloggers and the food writers. And not because we're working the systems, because we do enjoy the community. It's really fun. But we didn't tell anyone about this. I still remember we opened on a Wednesday night. 500 people showed up on Wednesday. And that Thursday, 700 people showed up. And that Friday, 800 people showed up. And that Saturday, 1,000 people showed up. It was unbelievable. And I don't attribute that entirely to us. That's, I think, partially us, but it's mainly because it was just a cool idea that people in the community had been watching, like, kind of gestate and then become a reality. And 2 years later, it'll be 2 years this October, Button Mash is still around. Part of the Echo Park community, it still has all our food. You can get the balls, our balls in your mouth there. And actually, the Crispy Toast Balls, being our number one dish we've ever made since we started out of our apartment, is still the top seller of any item, including beer and food, at Button Mash. So, yeah, I guess we're still around.
I couldn't believe that the Crispy Tofu Balls were in the cookbook because I was like, oh my God, that's like, you just gave away the secret recipe to the magic. But then I realized, you know what? I'm never going to make it at home. I'm going to always come and get it. Like, maybe if I was, like, living in Ohio, I would do that. But I can go and get it done really well and not fry up a bunch of balls in my kitchen. But really, truly, one of the best tofu dishes ever.
Thank you.
We love it.
It was literally the last dish we created in our apartment, so we had no idea.
Well, I have to say that watching you all these years has always been a point of inspiration for myself. I always find it's weird, but I find some parallels between the acting industry and the restaurant industry when it comes to you, just because you have such a clear point of view of who you are and you have your fans. You sometimes don't have fans. And to watch you persevere through the uncertainty and the ups and downs, watching you achieve success on such a viral, huge level, but then be transparent about how difficult it is so refreshing and so inspiring. Because I think, you know, like whatever industry you're in, there's shit and you have to really love what you're doing. And so to see somebody like you guys who really love what you're doing, but to still be so honest about how, yeah, the great times are wonderful, but there's also some really crappy times. Like, it just makes us all realize, you know, it's not always just grass is greener on the other side and just wanting what everyone else has, which I think is an easy thing to do, especially in the world of social media, in the world of Hollywood, in the world where you're just selling yourself and you don't want to show anything other than the smile, fake it till you make it sort of side of yourself, you know? And
yeah,
so...
Yeah, and that's actually what I've, in my recent social media, I've been sharing the pain, because everyone wants to share the positive, and I think vulnerability is something that more people yearn for, they just don't get enough of.
Yeah, and I mean, it really comes... That's so important to hear, especially, like, since you guys are doing so great right now, and to still show that is really... I don't know. I want to thank you for that, because, you know, we've known each other a long time. We have a lot of history. This podcast has been a long time in the making. But I wanted to, you know, like, do it properly, because...
I appreciate that.
Because I feel like you have a really complex, long story to tell, and I've enjoyed going on the ride with you, and I just want to thank you. I mean, like, I feel like I'm a part of your family in a lot of ways. I mean, your son played my son. We did a modeling shoot together. He was the best baby, by the way.
That's,
yeah. What was that for? It was like for like a baby monitor in China. I wonder if we're like on boxes. I wonder if like you went to China, if you would see me and your son all over those baby monitor boxes.
We did go to China like 3 months ago, but we didn't actually speak that out. So hopefully one day someone in China will recognize Killian and you and send us a little Instagram selfie and we'll find out one day.
It would be very exciting. So the book is beautiful. It's out now. You can catch you at Button Mash. And where else can people find you?
Obviously social medias, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all either at Starry Kitchen, starrykitchen.com. We cater too, so people can reach out to us if they want us to cater. I don't know. I seem to be doing a lot more television, which is really weird.
I don't think that's weird. You're such a personality, Wynn.
It's funny because people see me. The few times I've been on TV, people think it's an act, but then when they get on set for the next TV shows, they realize, oh man, he's not an act. He's just always on. I'm like, how do I act like anyone else but myself? I don't know why anyone would do that.
Well, you're so sweet, Wynn, for thinking that.
I'm a horrible actor. I really am. I did an infomercial back in like 2001, and I just walked off set like, this is horrible. I can't act like this. I'm out.
What are your hopes for Killian in the future? I know he's a little baby model.
Well, that wasn't even a hope. That was just a more fun experience. I just hope he is not an asshole. This is number one. I really want him to be fairly worldly. I want him to know that he should not live in my shadow. Like, we didn't buy him any banana stuff. All the fans have bought him banana stuff. It's funny because everyone's like, why wouldn't you have bought him banana stuff? It's so cute. It's like, because I don't want to impose myself on him that early on in life, because it can have an effect on him, because he might feel like he has to live up to that, and I don't want him to think that at all.
Right.
I know he's only 15 months old, and they're like, well, he's just 15 months old. Like, I don't understand. For me, like, again, I'm all in or not in. If I'm going to take one path, like, I need to represent that path. And I don't want to impose it on other people, but for me, that's really important, because then it's easy for me to be consistent that way as a person, as an operator, you know, as a chef or whatever it is. I want him to be happy. I want to expose him to so much art and culture. I want him not to have the identity issues I had. So I always say, I really mean it, I want to live part-time in Asia in a couple of years. And I want to share new experiences with him. So it's not always me teaching him, but it's me learning with him. So he just becomes a good person later on in life. And whether it be something he's passionate about, well, I want him to be passionate in general, but whether it be something that, you know, like he's an artist or he's like a high-fluting CEO, like, as long as he's happy, that's all I care about.
And one last question, which I always ask everyone, especially if they live in Los Angeles, what are your three top places to go like go-to places in Los Angeles?
Hardest question for me. First, I'll preface it by saying I fancy myself a food anthropologist now. I like to go to lots of places that are classic places in different areas, so it makes it much harder because I seek out a lot of stuff. My top three, I'm going to go with gut feelings. One is a place that's really close to my house. It's called Sumitas Don Adrian. It's a Oaxacan, like, Sumitas restaurant. It's amazing. It's a tiny spot in between a laundromat and a liquor store on Victory and Kester in Van Nuys. And these sandwiches are fucking amazing. And it's funny because, you know, in L.A., I think tortas rule L.A. more than Sumitas do, so a lot of people don't know what Sumitas are. It's, the bread is just not dense. It's fluffy, and they put, like, vanilla cheese on it, and it had this thing called a fina adobada, which is like a cold marinated cooked beef. And they put chipotle. It's just perfect. It's so good.
Sounds good.
But it's great because they're very genuine. Because for me, it's also the experience being in a place is very important. And going there, it's no frills. They're really nice. There's only three tiny tables that fit two people each. And, you know, it's not meant to be any more than that. And I love that. That's one. The second place is, I love Howling Rays so much. And I might say that because I am friends with Johnny.
Yeah, he's great. And his wife.
They're, I don't think they're Jewish, but they are mensches. They're total salt of the earth kind of people. But with that said, they also have the best fucking fried chicken I've had in my life. Their preparation of fried chicken is immaculate. It is inspiring. It is, it's not an institution yet, it is institutional. It has to be something that will never go away. Like, I've eaten all the new hot chicken places and all the fried chicken places in L.A., and I grew up in Texas, and there's a lot of fried chicken out there. Like, I've had nothing like it, and consistently, like, almost perfect. And I say almost perfect because there's always a variation. I don't mean that as a condescending little way to kind of take them down, but it's so good. And then on top of that, the experience, he's done something that I've always tried to do with my guys. Like, I haven't been able to foster. Like, his guys are a team. Like, you come in, and whenever it feels like it, he'll say something to the team, and they'll call out to you, right? And they make you feel just alive. It's like going into a Japanese restaurant, and they're like, "Urashimase," and that's that energy. But this is more like, it's a frantic, like, you're getting pumped up, and you've waited an hour and a half to get this fried chicken. And guess what? It's going to be worth it. And you're here, and you're our guest, and have some fucking fun. I love Howling Rays so much. So good. Last, third, oh my God, that is so hard. I'm going to go with a very simple comfort food, fra filet on Garvey, right off of Rosemead in El Monte, is my favorite fra in Los Angeles, and it is consistently perfect, light, clear. They always give you more meat than you need, but it's super good. The noodles are always clean, they're not powdery. Something that is kind of off-putting for me when I eat pho, and I always feel good walking out of that place, and I always feel satiated, or sated, whatever version of that word you want to use. Those are the top three I can give you off the top of my head.
That's great. I'm excited to try all of them except for Howling Rays, which I've already tried, but I will go back again. So thank you so much, Wynn, and give my love to T and to Killian. And just so happy about this book and everything that you've accomplished. And I love being your friend, and I love being part of the Starry Kitchen family.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you so much. I love being your friend, too. It's been fun growing up together.
Yeah.